action Flintstones movie. You probably haven't seen it, and that makes sense. But I treated that shit like I was in charge of delivering camera lenses to Orson Welles on the set of Citizen Kane. I would take a full schedule of college classes in the morning, then speed down to Universal Studios, where production was centered, then back to USC or Hollywood to find a battle. No one at Viva Rock Vegas or any of the contacts I was making in the movie industry knew anything about my double life as a lyrical destroyer, and I liked it that way. I was nervous they'd hear me insulting some poor kid's mother for being an example of human waste, give or take 8 pounds, she's Hairspray era Ricky Lake, then fire me for being an insensitive asshole. Now imagine me telling this part of the story huddled around a fire with a bone pierced through my nose, because it's important to note that back in 1999, there were no iPods or satellite radios yet. Because I had a daily commute to the Flintstones gig, I was forced to listen to terrestrial radio. Yes, with the commercials and everything. Radio stations like Power 106 and The Beat in LA and Hot 97 in New York set the trends in the urban music landscape because they were basically the only shows in town. This was especially the case in Los Angeles, where I found myself gridlocked in traffic for a majority of this drive. Regional captivity made listening to the radio a big deal, and that's how I got a second chance at rap stardom. Created by West Coast radio personalities Nick and Eric Vidal, DJ Brothers, collectively known as the Baker Boys, the world-famous Roll Call was a daily on-air competition where four or five aspiring MCs would call in and compete against each other with witty battle rap lines over an instrumental beat. The listeners would then vote on who came back the following weekday as champion, and that winner's reign would continue until they were defeated. It started in the early 90s and became a staple on Los Angeles radio, then spread to other cities, including New York, where it was also incredibly popular. Supposedly, rapper The Game competed when he was young, way before he ever told us how we do. As a kid, a little bit before the extra large era, I was going by the name Shucks, a reference to the aw shucks vibe I gave off to rappers before I devoured their souls, and had started competing in the Roll Call occasionally, later actually winning once in ninth grade. But the real battle back then was against my nerves, so much so that you'd hear the tremble in my voice when I rhymed. I had no problem stepping on stage to open for Ice-T's crew as a child, but I'd given the Roll Call such importance that I was terrified. My friend Allie had strung together a few consecutive wins once, and I couldn't have been more jealous. But my dreams of finding stardom through a somewhat forgettable radio contest had faded away once I made the decision to focus on fitting in at high school. I had never really thought about entering the fold again, but when I heard the Baker Boys announce they were looking for Roll Call contestants on my way home from work in 1999, after I'd watched Stephen Baldwin play Barney Rubble for hours on end, I knew it was time for my trembling and now slightly deeper voice to be heard once again. When I was younger, it had been almost impossible to get through on the station's hotline once they started requesting Roll Call challengers. In all honesty, I spent maybe 15% of sixth grade listening to a busy signal. So when I got through on my first attempt that day, almost 10 years later, I was startled. The show's producer, J-Love, who had now been screening high quantities of shitty rappers for years, answered with just the order, "Rap now!" I quickly fell into line, freestyling out, "Any other rappers getting jumped over like hurdles? I keep it underground next to those four mutant turtles." I started another bar, but was abruptly put on hold without a response. It left me slightly nervous that he had recognized that fearful preteen who sounded like a rapping Katharine Hepburn and hung up, assuming I would crack on live radio. He did eventually come back to ask my name, and that's the exact moment I froze. I hadn't planned on the station picking up the phone, let alone inquiring about my name, so I stumbled with the answer. I knew that if I said Jensen and then fucked up, everyone would know who it was. I'd hardly be able to hide behind my strange name. I'd throw away any credibility I had built in campus competitions, and kids from Calabasas would finally have the validation they needed for pushing me to hang up the mic in high school. Had I known how big of a deal this one decision would become, I would have made damn sure the first thing that came to mind wasn't Hot Carl, a slang term for shitting on someone's chest during sex. And just like that, I was Hot Carl. It was a dumb term I had heard thrown around a frat house by dudes, right in the mix with other acts you won't find in the Kama Sutra, like a Dirty Sanchez or Donkey Punch. Although chosen randomly, the name actually made sense. My whole life, after I annihilated rapper after rapper, people would say, "You just shit on that guy." I had now unintentionally picked a moniker that confirmed their claim. Within seconds of rechristening myself, I was live on air, going back and forth with the Baker Boys as the last contestant of the day. The Roll Call had a call-and-response format, where the DJs initially asked your name with their own set rap. One for the treble, two for the rhyme, it's the Roll Call, who's on that line? And you responded with your own two lines as an answer. Then the DJs asked for your location. That sounds cool, and that may be, where you calling from, what city? and you would rap back with another two bars, somehow incorporating your hometown into the lyrics. The goal was to be as skilled as possible, using humorous punchlines to assert your dominance over whoever else was rapping that day. Obviously, you couldn't see what your competition looked like, so you had to be creative with your attacks. I knew a little rust would be unavoidable for my return to the roll call, but also figured I'd be better than any contestant they'd find, as long as I kept the nerves at bay. So I wasn't surprised when I was crowned that day's winner with my big line, "I could take you down with many styles, faster slow-mo, because my skills are more in sync than those five singing homos." It wasn't anything to brag about, especially with this embarrassingly homophobic insult, which is a cornerstone of battle rap and one of the many archaic practices still seen in the culture today. I see you too, misogyny. As gross as it was, I was coming back the next day for a possible second win, a goal that seemed attainable now, especially since they gave me a private winner's phone number to avoid the dreaded busy signal of my childhood. I was ready for whatever competition the roll call would bring my way, but didn't expect much to come of my new endeavor. At most, it was a goof. Something to laugh about in a few days when I was dethroned and back to focusing on making endless copies of the Flintstones script. I didn't plan on telling any of my college friends about the win, or on turning it into a tool to bring attention to a music career. I just thought it seemed like fun. Even when I completed an entire week of consecutive victories, starting a streak rarely heard on the roll call, I still prepared myself for it to end at any moment. But it didn't. I may not have seen it coming, but this was the start of something big. Very big. Even bigger than Viva Rock Vegas. Chapter 4. Mac-10's Briefcase. Before I knew it, 2 weeks had passed. I had 10 wins under my belt, and I was becoming a bit of a radio phenomenon. My voice had stopped trembling, and I wasn't just winning. I was pulverizing rappers with perfect wins, instances where every caller voted for the same contestant. The Baker Boys started advertising the roll call earlier in the day, replaying my appearances with the promise that LA's most talked about rapper would be competing later, which made me laugh while I was fetching coffee on a movie that would later be nominated for 4 Razzies. The Baker Boys quickly took an interest in learning more about Hot Carl, uncharacteristically interviewing me after victories, but I continued to keep my identity secret, mostly in fear that my bosses would find out, but also in case I eventually embarrassed myself. Eric and Nick were even taking bets from listeners on whether I was black or white. I'd usually perform the roll call from my dorm room, getting home just in time from class or work, but on some late Flintstones nights, I would have to lock myself in the script closet and hope no one walked by to hear me scream rhyming insults into an office phone. The Baker Boys started to have me freestyle to an instrumental of their choosing for extended amounts of time after my wins, forcing me to use an indoor voice to avoid suspicion from nearby coworkers. It truly was a pathetic sight, as the phone's cord would travel from my desk right into a closed closet, like I was dialing 911 and hiding from home invaders, or a teenage girl talking to a boy her parents forbade her from seeing. I was lucky my competition would never see my hiding place, because you ain't the hottest, you should just come out the closet, maybe the easiest and most perfectly homophobic battle knockout ever. I had tied the all-time record for most perfect wins in a row as I entered my 3rd week of victories. The Baker Boys invited me into the studio to compete until I was dethroned, an invitation that was rarely handed out, but also an obvious roadblock in keeping my identity secret. I contemplated sending in an actor to announce that I was terminally ill and could only rap over the phone from the hospital. I even visited a local costume shop to browse masks, but realized I would probably never win again if muffled by the latex face of Richard Nixon. I knew that no matter how hard I tried to avoid it, my anonymity was up. I would also have to start perfectly timing my Flintstones job so I could avoid traffic and make it to the studio, which sounded like a Mario Kart level of stress I wasn't thrilled to face. But when Monday came along, I finally stepped foot into the radio station I had basically taken hostage for weeks, and the studio exploded in surprise. The Baker Boys tried their hardest to explain my physical appearance. He's just a huge dork. But they couldn't stop laughing at me, and their own shock. I wore a bright Hawaiian shirt and sported the thick black-rimmed eyeglass style I still wear today, looking more like a member of Real Big Fish's horn section than the vicious battler they expected. Even corporate executives from the station came out of their offices to get a look at the rapper who had redefined the roll call for almost a month, but looked like he'd also do your taxes. I'd be lying if I said I didn't know my ultra-whiteness was a major element of my appeal. That's something I knew even during Extra Large. There had been white rappers before me, some of whom I openly idolized, like MC Search, the Beastie Boys, and Everlast, and Eminem was slowly gaining momentum during my breakout, but I still knew I was different from everyone else. I rapped only about what I knew, which for me was a suburban, pop culture-riddled life that, although familiar to most of the white fans flocking to hip-hop, had not yet been represented in the genre. Where 95% of rappers were talking about guns or jewelry, I was referencing the girls in my high school who got nose jobs, or spitting stupid lines like, I'm too obnoxious to be called conscious, I drive a rape van like the white B.A. Baracus. On the roll call, and throughout the years I was actively pursuing a career in hip-hop, I regularly heard the phrase, a white rapper who acts white, which is coded in racism, and beyond that, just dumb. I grew up loving rappers like Biz Markie, Dougie Fresh, and the Fat Boys, guys who had fun and didn't care about acting tough, and I wanted to bring that back. I called myself the Jewish Jay-Z, sampled Hall & Oates, and name-checked Dave Eggers. I wasn't making a racial statement, I was being honest. It's really all I could be. I was happy the listeners were appreciating the perspective. The roll call just got easier from that point on. I was experiencing an unstoppable stretch, racking up wins from inside the studio and trying my hardest to create entertaining radio. I brought in pinatas for the DJs to break if I won, and when they did, porn magazines came flying out. For one victory, I brought along USC sorority girls to boo after my opponent's lyrics and applaud after mine. I concocted ridiculous similes like, so here's your warning, at least half of y'all been told, I'm just like little Bow Wow, but white, Jewish, and old. And you can't get at me, you ain't getting raw, cause you're uneven like Wilson Phillips on a seesaw. I still didn't see Hot Carl as a long-term endeavor, but if this hobby was to play out publicly, I wanted to have fun with it. I was still able to keep my burgeoning rap life secret from my bosses at Viva Rock Vegas, but my classmates at USC were starting to catch on. As much as I tried to maintain a low profile, students would sometimes see me in the quad and yell, Hot Carl! And I even reluctantly signed an autograph during an international relations lecture. The university asked about my availability for the school's annual Spring Fling concert, and I ended up opening for Naughty by Nature, who called me the future of hip-hop during their set. Vinny even said, Eminem better get his running shoes. Things got chaotic once I hit 6 weeks of uninterrupted roll call victories, and I was just too busy juggling the radio appearances, my junior year, and my internship to even notice what was going on around me. But no matter how excited USC was about their newest musician, no one was prouder than my mom. Ever since I was a kid, both my parents had been incredibly supportive of my love for hip-hop, and I always assumed they were three or four of my daily roll call votes. But it was my mom, a singer who toured with the USO during the Vietnam War and wished she had taken her career further, who ended up being my biggest fan on the radio. While I avoided any and all conversation that could expose Hot Carl's identity to anyone, she always seemed just one step away from hiring a skywriter. I've joked that if she were Peter Parker's Aunt May, the police would have arrested Peter the day after the spider bit him. My mom was proud, and I appreciated that. But when our local dry cleaner wished me luck on the roll call, I knew she would make an awful candidate for the CIA. Another stop on her national Hot Carl publicity tour was the local shipping supply spot. She rented a mailbox there and would stop by throughout the week to pick up packages. When she casually dropped my accomplishments into a conversation with the store's owner one day, and by casually, I mean the same way people drop that they spent a semester of college abroad, she realized the woman also had a rapping son, well-known Inglewood gangster rapper, Mac 10. When my mom told me that Mac 10 would be listening to that night's roll call, I obviously had a few questions for her, starting with, how the fuck do you know Mac 10? She explained her earlier run-in, which meant that my mom knew more Bloods than I did. Even though the added pressure of Mac listening in didn't help my nerves, I notched another perfect victory, followed by an off-the-cuff freestyle that included the impromptu line, I'll battle on the radio, battle at a show, either way I'll run through lines like Bo Jackson at Tecmo Bowl, which ended up being the most quoted lyric I ever spit on the airwaves. I left the station feeling like a winner, ready for another weekend off, entering an unprecedented seventh week in a row. And that's when Mac 10 called my cell phone. I liked your raps, so I got your number from your mom's, Mac 10 said to me in a soft tone. I safely guessed this was a sentence he'd never said before. The man who once rapped, addicted to crime, so I stay in the mix, with a love for hoochie chicks and pulling jewelry licks, couldn't have been more polite. He kept repeating the Tecmo Bowl line, in total shock that it was actually freestyle. He asked where I'd be in a few hours, and I told him I planned on spending the weekend doing chores at my parents' house in Calabasas. Like every other rapper, I joked. Unfazed, he asked for the address and told me he'd see me soon. I assume when most people heard that from Mac 10, they feared for their lives. While my mom just wanted to know if she should make him a sandwich. When he pulled up in a Rolls Royce, smoking a cigar and holding a briefcase, I assumed my neighbors were all just going to pack up and move. Mac and I sat in my living room, feet from where I'd watched Punky Brewster as a child, and talked about Hot Carl. He admitted he'd only heard that day's roll call, but needed no more convincing. He was already a diehard fan. He explained his current situation at Capitol/Priority Records, and how because of his success with the supergroup West Side Connection, he could sign a rapper quickly, and he believed Hot Carl was the next worldwide superstar in hip-hop. Since this wasn't my first run-in with a gangster rapper promising riches, I was skeptical. That is until Mac placed his briefcase on my mother's coffee table and exposed $50,000 resting inside. "Look at this as a signing bonus," he went on to explain, as I wide-eyed the contents like the Goonies when they first see One-Eyed Willie's ship. In an interview about that night, he would later casually drop the gem, "I think that's just what I had on me at the time," when asked why he brought that specific amount to my parents' house. If I signed that night, he promised me more money, as well as an appearance on the upcoming West Side Connection album and a song with T-Boz from TLC, his wife at the time, which sounded awesome, but also seemed super awkward. I had seen enough of Suge Knight on Behind the Music to know that if I made a deal right there, things wouldn't end well. I thanked Mac for his confidence in me, but admitted the attention given to my hobby was still a bit overwhelming. I needed some time to think it over, and he politely said he understood my stress. He closed the briefcase and walked back to his car, which was worth more than my parents' yearly salaries combined. I waved goodbye, not believing the surreal shit that had just happened. Before Mac drove off, though, he rolled down his window and yelled Carl, a name I hadn't really heard much of yet, but would hear for years to come. I turned around, hoping he would just make it rain out of his driver's side window, no matter how I'd responded to his proposition. Instead, he offered advice that forced me to realize just how much my life was going to change. "Do me a favor," he asked. "Stop calling it a fucking hobby. You're about to be a millionaire, playboy." With that, Mac 10 drove off, and I went back inside my parents' house to do laundry. Chapter 5. Tyrese isn't happy. Despite having had the opportunity to pocket $50,000 in cash a few days earlier, that Monday I returned to school, my internship, and the radio station, still pinching pennies to exist. Final exams were steadily approaching, and I had already broken the radio station's previous record for most consecutive roll call victories by over a month, hitting around 40 consecutive days. So I wasn't sure I could maintain my hunger to keep participating. I told J-Love that I wanted to pull a Seinfeld and leave while on top, and that I planned on retiring at the end of the week. He passed along those words to the Baker Boys, and when I got to the studio that day and saw a management contract near the microphone, I was shocked and flattered. The DJs had never managed an artist before, but explained that they'd partner with their own management team, a company that represented names I didn't recognize, except for Jennifer Beals from Flashdance, and learn as they went. They'd been LA's premier radio personalities for years, so their connections were important, especially since radio was still the most crucial outlet for breaking a record. As a child, I had just hoped the Baker Boys would answer my phone call, and now they were trying to run my career. I didn't know what would happen once my roll call reign ended, and I had no idea if anyone actually cared about Hot Carl, but I figured an opportunity this big was worth exploring. I told them I'd think it over, and I included the line, "Might retire on Friday, let my career start to swell, or end up just handing out free demo CDs like AOL," during that day's victory. I walked out of the studio with their contract in hand and decided to treat myself to a taco at a nearby stand while I waited for rush hour traffic to die down. As I sat and stared at words like term period or commission, terminology I had never seen before this proposed agreement, I finally let the prospect of this new career path settle in. It was then that I heard some kids at a nearby table start talking excitedly. "He's the best rapper I've ever heard," a female teenager explained. "Does he have any songs out?" a guy who seemed to be her boyfriend asked. "No, he's just been on the radio for weeks. His name is Hot Carl and he's incredible." I knew they had no idea that the unassuming, pale motherfucker in the booth next to them, gnawing on a shrimp taco, was the Hot Carl they were talking about, so I took it as a sign. I thought to myself, holy shit, a lot of people are listening, but I couldn't commit to any contract until I actually came to grips with what was unfolding around me. I knew the Baker Boys' hearts and wallets were in the right place, but it all just seemed too early to limit myself to anything. I'd been living in a bubble during the roll call explosion, too busy with college and work to understand how many people had actually been exposed to Hot Carl. I decided to call J-Love from the car to ask for advice. As producer, he was the guy making sure I got on the radio every day, and we had forged a close relationship during the streak, so I knew he'd be honest. He understood my trepidation, reiterating that Nick and Eric only wanted to help, but that it might be best to not lock myself in anywhere yet. After the small pep talk, I knew my instincts were right. I would become a professional rapper, but I'd at least learn the landscape before I put my trust in anyone or anything. I told the Baker Boys my decision, and they seemed to totally understand, saying they'd still be willing to take me around to their connections. If anything were to come of it, I'd owe them their deserved commission, or in hip-hop terms, have to break them off. As I celebrated Y2K and readied myself for life without the roll call, it seemed everyone loved Hot Carl. Well, everyone except two guys. No matter how hard I trained to become a freestyle champion, the act itself wasn't easy. There are always shortcuts and tricks of the trade, but the pressure is real, especially when you're head-to-head with another skilled MC who's waiting for you to slip, stumble, or stutter. Once the Baker Boys started having me spit an entire verse after my wins, everything changed. Not only did I have to bring 8 lines for the normal call-and-response contest, but I also needed to produce somewhere between 16 and 32 bars every single day for my victory lap. I wasn't able to write all these out, mostly due to the lack of free time, but also because that was kind of cheating in the early 2000s. While freestyling has since become a term for just rapping an orphaned written verse over a random beat, it used to mean that you rapped impromptu off the top of your head, improvising almost every line. I hate to sound like an old man here and say that we had it harder, but we had it harder. Sometimes I was centered and on my game, while other times I definitely wasn't. Without written verses to fall back on, I often just called an audible mid-line and hoped I fell on my feet. I usually nailed my landings, but during my 3rd week of wins, when I found myself starting a verse with, "Excuse the next line because it may start some beef," I had no endgame. It was such a clear setup for a punchline, like when Jay Leno used to say, "Did you hear about this?" and follow it up with some hack bullshit he wrote in a Studebaker. But as those words came out of my mouth, I knew I had nothing. As I grasped for anything, the stanza became, "Excuse this next line because it may start some beef, but I'd rather kill myself than ever have a song with Tyrese." To be clear, I have nothing against Tyrese Gibson. It was only a few years after the Coke commercial that introduced him to the world, and he had just released his first album, a record that went on to go platinum and win a Grammy. Small note, the Ramones never won a Grammy. It's just a fact that seems relevant here. I can't tell you if I had heard any of his songs at this point, but I knew his name rhymed with beef, and I found it humorous that I would rather take my own life than step foot into his studio. The Baker Boys immediately started laughing. They understood how ridiculous and random the line was, which is something I can't say for the 3 people who called me over the next hour, asking why I hated Tyrese so much. At first, I admitted the truth to my friends. Honestly, his name rhymed, that's it. But as the inquiries kept coming in, including an email from an underground hip-hop site asking for a comment, I realized I should be having more fun with our supposed bad blood. So I fabricated reasons, from saying Tyrese stole my girlfriend, to saying he cut me off in traffic, causing a flat tire. The weird part is, people believed me. So when I walked into the studio the next day, I had every single word that rhymed with Tyrese on tap, ready to go. And just like that, "People want to know why I had words about Tyrese? Trust me, he knows, and I'll see him in the streets," came out of my mouth for no reason at all. Again, the Baker Boys couldn't stop laughing, probably because they saw the absurd face I made when attempting to threaten an R&B singer in the streets. As I left the studio, 3 calls turned into 6, and 1 voice message from my mom asked me to stop antagonizing Tyreef. But the concern only fueled my fire, and I saw no end in sight for this silly conflict with Black Tie. It became a harmless part of my daily roll call folklore, until supposedly, Tyrese found out. I strutted into the studio during week 4, head held high and ready to add another victory to my tally, when I noticed Jay Love's concerned face. He immediately pulled me into a side office and whispered, "Tyrese isn't happy." My immediate reaction was not concern for my health, but concern for how quickly I could get the phrase, "Tyrese isn't happy," onto t-shirts to sell to fans. Jay Love saw me start to laugh and cut me off with a sentiment I first heard from Mac 10 in my parents' driveway, but would encounter consistently throughout my attempt to become a professional rapper. "You may want to start taking this serious." He explained that Tyrese hadn't actually heard anything I said, but a friend told him that someone on the radio had a problem with him. The Baker Boys assured him it was all in good fun, but Tyrese didn't seem to comprehend any part of it. He, understandably, had no idea who I was, yet I was assuring Los Angeles that he knew why I wanted to beat him up. So J-Love made me promise to calm it down, and I obliged. But that day, during my freestyle session, after long consideration and at a loss for words again, I decided that no matter how much I appreciated my well-being, I wasn't done with this stupidity. Halfway through my extended rap session, I rhymed, "I promised I'd stop bad-mouthing Tyrese like I've been, but that's hard for me. I'm a bad actor just like him." J-Love shook his head, trying to hide his laughter, and I continued to make fun of Tyrese for the rest of my roll call reign and maybe 10 other times on songs I recorded throughout my career. And weirdly, I never heard a word from Tyrese, probably because he didn't actually care or because J-Love had just been fucking with me. But despite the silence, I still found it necessary to clear the air, even if it was years later. Fast forward 6 years to when Tyrese would often get manicures and pedicures next door to a place where I worked, which is a sentence that should have gotten me a book deal on its own. One day I watched as a white Rolls Royce pulled into our parking lot, and the man I had methodically dissed day after day, song after song, stepped out and made his way to the adjoining nail bar. Without any real preparation or plan, I instinctively yelled his name, and thus began one of the most awkward exchanges of my life. I yelled, "Tyrese." Tyrese turned around and was like, "Yeah?" I said, "Hey, man, I just want to say I'm sorry." "Sorry for what?" he asked. "It's not important. I just think it's worth saying. You literally did nothing." Tyrese asked, "What?" "Nothing. Love, June, baby boy." I walked back inside my office with a skip in my step, and Tyrese could not have looked more confused. He looked around nervously, waiting for Ashton Kutcher to pop out and expose a camera. But instead, after a few seconds, he just made his way into the salon without any further fanfare. I figured that exchange was the amends I needed to make, and the less he knew about it, the better. Poking fun at Tyrese wasn't one of my more admirable moments as Hot Carl, and in the end, he actually seemed like a nice dude. Unfortunately, his name just rhymes with beef. And honestly, had I known he got weekly mani-pedis, it would have ended like Biggie and Tupac. Not all of my tense encounters with celebrities were as nonchalant or as insignificant to my career, especially the one with the other guy who seemed to dislike Hot Carl. When talking about music in the early 2000s, it would be hard not to mention the industry's version of Herpes Simplex 2, Fred Durst. No matter how hard you tried to get rid of him, he was going to pop up in some fashion over and over again. He had found astounding success with Limp Bizkit and became an efficient Interscope music executive, signing both mediocre, Puddle of Mud, Stained, and impressive, Kenna and She Wants Revenge, acts to his own label, Flawless Records. Fred was the poster boy for the music industry gold rush, selling over 40 million records worldwide and scoring 3 Grammy nominations. Small note, Jimi Hendrix was only nominated for a Grammy once. It's just another fact that seems relevant. Limp Bizkit's sacrilegious cover of George Michael's Faith to the braggadocio bullshit of Roland is the musical equivalent of seeing old pictures of yourself wearing hammer pants in the 90s. I recently visited a Hard Rock Cafe and saw one of Fred's signature red baseball caps immortalized under glass, and I immediately feared that the Hard Rock curators weren't actually interested in rock and roll history. They were just hoarders. But to his credit, there were few rock stars bigger than Fred Durst in the year 2000. So during my roll call days, when I first heard he was interested in signing me to his record label, I was ready to learn more. My connection to Durst began a week or two into the roll call, when I had been thrilled to hear that Limp Bizkit's DJ, DJ Lethal, was a Hot Carl fan. Lethal first jumped on the scene as part of the Caucasian trio House of Pain, a rap group that heavily influenced my love for hip-hop and helped me understand my own place within the genre, so he'll always get a pass. Like how Tara Reid was in The Big Lebowski, so I still follow her on Twitter. When that group went their separate ways, he quickly joined a rock band, a trend I can happily say faded away rather quickly, but really worked out for DJ Lethal. A mutual friend set up a meeting, and without any time wasted, I was making music at his studio in the Valley, just blocks away from my parents' house. We created a song that would later make its way onto my demo tape and help cement my record deal, but at the time we were just two guys fucking around. Lethal was also part of a weekly LA radio show on a rival of the station where I was battling every day, airing his episodes on Sunday night. So when he told me he'd be playing one of our songs on his show, I knew that meant even more exposure. Since it would be the first time I'd have an actual song on the airwaves, rather than just my battle lyrics over someone else's beat, I alerted all my friends and family and told them when to listen. My grandma, who didn't fully understand the roll call and what my success on it meant, was thrilled to finally comprehend this milestone and excitedly told me she'd be listening. My mom, who up to this point had taped and announced to anyone within a 50-foot radius every one of my roll call wins, was basically one step away from transcribing the song in case someone she knew was hard of hearing. While I was usually nervous about the live nature of my battles, I felt relaxed and confident in this case. I didn't even need to be in the studio or on the phone. Halfway through the show, DJ Lethal announced an exclusive song he was excited to play, and I could hear the sound of everyone I knew pressing record on his or her tape player at the same time. He had the first song ever from LA rap phenomenon Hot Carl and would play it next. But first he wanted to welcome this week's special show guest, his bandmate, Fred Durst. I had no prior warning of Fred's appearance, but figured it was perfect timing since I had just heard about his interest in me. They warmed up by asking Fred about his recent tour and the upcoming MTV Video Music Awards, questions I'm sure he answered with a perfectly measured amount of angst while I waited patiently with bated breath for the debut of my songwriting skills. After about 10 minutes, they introduced my song and asked Fred if he had heard of Hot Carl. Fred said something along lines of, "Yeah, he's got all the buzz right now. I'm excited to check this out." And just like that, I had an epic introduction from the man who penned Nookie, a setup I couldn't have paid for. The first few notes of my song played, and I just sat back and smiled. A shot-in-the-dark phone call to a dumb rap contest from a suburbanite who once sharded in 6th grade PE and as a result had his mom pick him up from the nurse's office had turned into a song dope enough to play on LA radio. My mom called me freaking out about the track, like it was Marvin Berry calling his cousin Chuck during the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. Everything sounded perfect, and I felt well on my way to a professional level for the first time since the false start I'd had with Ricky as a child. Then the song ended, and they asked Fred Durst what he thought. "He's a huge nerd. It's not for me. He's not going anywhere," Fred Durst said without a hint of sarcasm in his voice. I could feel the silent shock in the studio, even through the radio. I tilted my head slightly, pretending for a second I had misheard his statement, but knowing damn well I hadn't. Fred went on to insult me and imitate my voice as the show's host defended me. They went to a commercial break without any sign that Durst was letting up, and now I was fuming. Did this piece of shit just halt my career before it even started? The man who in 1998 performed atop a giant toilet at Ozfest had made himself the gatekeeper of hip-hop, and for some unknown reason he had just announced he wasn't letting me in. As I stared at my radio, stunned by what had just unfolded, my phone rang, finally breaking the coma. It was my ecstatic grandmother, so happy she had just heard my song and oblivious to what Fred had just unleashed. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure she was even listening to the right station, but at that point I didn't care. I thanked her politely, hung up, and plotted my next move. The show was still on commercial break. Not knowing what Fred would say next, I decided to take matters into my own hands and dialed into the station. I tussled with a busy signal for a few minutes until Lethal picked up. "Put me on the air," I demanded. Lethal sensed my rage. I could hear him walking into another room to avoid Fred hearing. "Dude, he doesn't mean it," Lethal explained. "Fuck him, he doesn't mean it," I shouted back. "If he wants a battle, he found one." I spoke with a real Tony Soprano confidence that clashed with the 125-square-foot dorm room and thrift store Alf slippers I found myself in at the time. Lethal said he believed putting me on air with Fred was a bad idea, given my current state, but that he'd talk to him and make things right. I heard the call waiting alert on my phone and put Lethal on hold, only to hear my mom, confused, on the other line. "Who's this Fred Durst?" she asked, in a disgusted tone more warranted when talking about child molesters and serial killers than rock stars. "He's a rock guy. I'm on the other line with him right now." "You are?" she asked. "How'd you get through? I've been trying for 5 minutes." "Wait, what? Why are you calling them?" "To yell at him. How dare he?" Fearing for even more damage in my career, I begged my mother to stop calling. I could only imagine the field day he'd have with her. "They'll know it was you, Mom," I said, annoyed, hoping to knock some sense into her. "I was going to use a fake voice," she said, in a voice that was clearly fake, in the same way that Kermit the Frog and a bunch of Muppets in a trench coat were clearly a fake tall man. "Mom, do not call them," I demanded. She promised she wouldn't, so I returned to Lethal's line. He assured me he'd fix the problem and begged me to just stay tuned. "You two will live in perfect harmony," Lethal promised. "Fred can never be in harmony. Have you ever heard him sing?" I yelled to remind him that I'm always ready to battle. I listened closely as the final commercial break faded out. So before we went to break, Fred had some things to say about Hot Carl, a rapper whose first song we debuted here on the show, Lethal announced, like he was about to apologize for a weatherman yelling fuck after being stung by a bee during a live broadcast. And now Fred wants to say something. "Yeah, man, I was just messing around," Fred said politely. "I just want him to diss me next. He's going to be a big deal. I'm trying to make him famous. I may even sign the kid." I let out a sigh of relief, marking some closure to this weird turn of events. "Yeah, we got a lot of callers mad at you, dude," Lethal informed Fred Durst. "One man said you were fat and knew nothing." Fred joked that he wanted none of that, and they went on to the next song, leaving a potential Hot Carl beef in the dust. I was finally feeling relaxed when my phone rang. It was my mother. "I'm happy that all worked out," she proclaimed. "He said he might even sign you." "I'm not interested. I mean, he seems like a psychopath." My mom quickly responded, "Yeah, and he's fat and knows nothing," in an obviously fake voice. I prayed the radio station didn't have caller ID. No matter who did or didn't appreciate my newfound career, it was time for my run on the radio to come to an end after almost 2 months of domination. So for my final appearance on the roll call, the Baker Boys arranged for an all-time roll call championship at an El Torito restaurant in West Covina. The idea was to bring together past champions in front of fans and have us compete against each other, leaving just one past winner victorious with the undisputed title. When I first heard the idea of a roll call with a live audience, I wondered who would even care to see it. Before YouTube, rap battles were confined to ciphers, surrounded by 35 onlookers yelling, "Oh!" at the end of every punchline and trying to start an actual fight. They took on a real Fight Club vibe, so much so that one of the more infamous New York competitions ended up co-opting that name soon after. Battling was one of hip-hop's best-kept secrets, so I couldn't help but wonder how far the whispers could travel for this blockbuster roll call. I convinced a few friends to make the trip with me, both for moral support and to keep me busy in case only 8 people showed up. On the drive there, I practiced tirelessly, hoping that the weeks of dedicating my time to a few minutes of regional radio would actually result in some sort of title in the end. Between Mac-10's ridiculous offer, the Baker Boys' management aspirations, and the unknowing young couple at the taco stand talking about me, I was now willing to see rap as more than a hobby. But for now, this win was all I had my sights set on. As we pulled into the parking lot, I immediately noticed a crowd of maybe 100 people lined up outside the restaurant, one holding a sign that read, "Fuck Tyrese." My friends were thrilled by the unexpected crowd. I was just nervous I'd lose. Most were in attendance just to see what I looked like and were shocked to see me emerge when it was my time to rap. One guy actually yelled, "Is Hot Carl John Cusack?" Although I was only one of a dozen MCs competing that day, it felt like everyone was just waiting to hear what I had in store for the championship round. The Baker Boys had set me up to rap last, giving me the final word, and I didn't disappoint. I ended with the line, "You can't battle Hot Carl. What's that about? You ain't doing nothing like AC Green in a whorehouse." A reference to an NBA player who had recently announced that he was a virgin, and the restaurant went ballistic. I hadn't heard that type of reaction since I dismantled toothbrush during lunch break. There was no doubt that I had won the title as I ominously mean-mugged the crowd and gave exuberant high fives to the front row, like I just 360 dunked on Kevin Garnett. As a lifelong fan of the roll call, I felt like I had just made history. The Baker Boys had me perform my usual victory lap, but this time going down the line of past victors and dissing them one by one. They assured me they'd cut to commercial break so I could curse in front of the audience without worrying about affecting the station. When I got to a young boy reminiscent of middle school Jensen, the kid who once dreamed of participating but only got busy signals, I pulled no punches. "You shouldn't even be here. All your wins were shit. You're a kid allowed to battle because of a mom's permission slip." I called another past winner a gay Rick Fox because, well, that's what he looked like. The place erupted again. I'm not sure I've experienced that type of validation from anything I've done since, and it's safe to say I probably won't ever again. I walked out of the restaurant, understanding that my skills were no longer confined to the radio or college parties. I felt unbeatable. I still had to go run errands at the Flintstones production office come Monday, but for now I signed a dozen or so autographs on my way to the car, content with leaving the roll call and pursuing a career in hip-hop. Even if I didn't know what, if anything, could happen next. Chapter 6. Rap Game Lloyd Dobler. The next morning, J-Love called to congratulate me on the victory, admitting he had never seen anything like it during his career as a radio producer. He also revealed that during my time on the show, he had been compiling a list of record executives and industry folk who had called to ask about me. However, like a teammate avoiding a pitcher during a perfect game, he had decided to keep those inquiries to himself until the streak was broken or I decided to walk away. Now that I had retired from the roll call, he rattled off some recognizable names as interested parties. Eminem was all over MTV, so a lot of industry types saw dollar signs without even hearing or caring about any of my music. I began following up on some of the interests, which ranged from worth a second look to absolutely ridiculous. DJ Pooh, Ice Cube producer and co-writer of Friday, pitched the Baker Boys an idea where I would take on an alter ego, Hot Carl the Pimp, and wear floor-length fur coats and big hats, traveling with women everywhere I went. When I asked why I would do that, I was told, "'Cause you look goofy as yourself." Manager Jeff Quantnance, who co-founded a company called The Firm, which represented Jennifer Lopez and Korn, seemed to be the most esteemed of the bunch, so I decided to hold off and contact him last. I hoped I would be more knowledgeable by then, but I knew damn well that no matter what happened, this situation would never make sense. In the meantime, the Baker Boys were very close to one of the other possible suitors, Rough House Records co-founder Chris Schwartz, so I decided they'd take me to meet him and be involved in any dealings that came of it. In turn, they made an appointment with Schwartz at a posh Beverly Hills hotel during his trip to LA for the Grammys. On our drive there, I noticed a boombox in the Baker Boys' back seat and immediately felt nervous. They explained that the portable tape player was for rapping on the spot in the meeting, which in all honesty was my absolute nightmare. Then they informed me that Chris didn't actually have a room in that hotel. It was just conveniently located near his previous meeting. So now I envisioned myself spitting a verse, holding up a boombox like I was Lloyd Dobler and Say Anything, in the middle of a crowded restaurant. Despite my fears, they promised me everything would be fine since it was just for Chris, someone who wanted to meet me, and not like I was a street performer just asking for dollars from strangers. They also emphasized that to make it in this business, I'd have to be willing to rhyme at the drop of a hat, which seemed like a ringing endorsement for just going back to college and pretending this whole thing never happened. But I sucked it up and we pulled into the valet line. As we waited our turn, I noticed Missy Elliott getting out of the car in front of us. I knew it was Missy, mostly because she was wearing a purple leather pantsuit with razor blades glued to almost every inch, and there was no other human being in the world who would wear that shit. The only thing that would have clued me in quicker was if she were wearing a huge garbage bag and making weird car noises with her mouth. I nonchalantly pointed her out from the back seat, almost laughing, not expecting the Baker Boys to jump out of the car and talk to her, which is exactly what they did. Because they were an LA radio institution, everyone stopped by their show at some point to shamelessly promote their music. I figured there weren't many rappers they didn't know, at least in passing, and this theory was proven true when, one cold night on a Beverly Hills sidewalk, I shook hands with Missy Elliott. I was introduced as Ha Carl, a name I was becoming accustomed to, and during our brief interaction, I found her to be a pleasant lady. I was starting to walk toward the lobby to find Chris Schwartz when I heard the Baker Boy start pitching me as the next big rapper to Missy. Now, obviously, this was an extremely nice gesture by Nick and Eric, promoting me at every turn. But like a skilled quarterback, I could predict the open hole where a defensive lineman was about to sack me and push me back 15 yards. Envisioning the next four steps of their conversation, I knew that in just a few seconds, they'd be pressing play on that boombox and something awful was going to happen. I was going to perform publicly for Missy Elliott on a Beverly Hills street corner. If I was tepid about the eventual Schwartz dinner table freestyle, imagine my feelings about this. The one thing the Baker Boys promised me was that I wouldn't feel like a street performer, and here I was about to be a literal street performer. Everything played out exactly like my nightmare. The Baker Boys suggested I rap for her, and the anxiety took over my entire body, even though "you have to be willing to rhyme at the drop of a hat" echoed through my head over and over again. We were surrounded by valets, hotel guests, and passersby, all coming and going in LA's stuffiest elite neighborhood, and I was about to pretend this intersection was 106 and Park. Missy commented on my unorthodox appearance and admitted she didn't know what to expect. And then Eric pressed play on the portable player, an action I saw happen in slow motion. I officially sensed disaster from every angle. As the absurd notion sank in that I was about to flow for, or accost, depending on how you saw it, Missy Elliott, a musician I highly respected, as she entered her hotel for the night. Everything was happening so fast that I started rapping without really thinking, a cardinal sin in freestyling. I pretty much blacked out from that point on, but I do remember two things for sure. Number one, at some point I said, "They asked me to rap for Missy, now I got a rocket. Who got the keys to my Jeep? I bet valet's got it," and pointed to a valet guy. Number two, and this is directly related to number one, I was awful. I'm not sure if I was expecting Missy to just start popping and locking or something, but she sort of just sat there and listened. Rather than stop and huddle around me in amazement, anyone walking by paused for a second, looked, then snickered and kept walking. For as far as Hot Carl had progressed up to this point, that night brought me right back to square one. I felt like I was a young, untalented juggler being forced onto the street by his parents to make rent and accidentally dropping balls for the uninterested. For impromptu rap to be impressive, a lot of pieces have to fall into place, and I was so uncomfortable that it showed in my performance. I couldn't even remember some of my old standbys I would use in case of emergencies. I could sense the Baker Boys' disappointment as I wrapped up the verse and hung my head as the final word left my mouth. I immediately hoped there'd be a third Flintstones movie, because I had student loans to pay off, and I just fucked my dreams. Missy wished me luck politely and walked into her hotel. Luckily, before I could pull a razor blade off her jacket and slit my wrists. It makes sense that the meeting with Chris Schwartz afterward didn't feel right. He had helped develop Cypress Hill, the Fugees, and Crisscross, but I couldn't get the Missy audition out of my head, imagining that it looked like a homeless man competing on The Voice. I couldn't get my swagger back, and I came off as an insecure amateur looking for a record deal. Shockingly, Chris was still interested, though he knew I needed some work. He kindly gave me some advice that helped me over the next few years, but we never met again. As we walked out of the hotel, the Baker Boys did their best to make me feel better about the fumble, but I knew it was a blown opportunity. There would be chances like these again, and now I knew what not to do when they appeared. The valet pulled our car up, and we headed over. I was walking around to the back seat, defeated, when the valet guy walked up and handed me a dollar bill. He didn't say a word. He just ran to the next car that needed attending to. I'll never know whether I had dropped it or whether it was change I was supposed to give to Eric, but I'll always assume it was my first tip as a professional street performer, and thankfully my last. Meetings got easier as time passed, and I gained more experience with each introduction. I started to book shows too, especially on campus, where I was becoming the go-to guy for an opening act. Every flyer at USC for the next month included the name Hot Carl, alongside a rising student rap group called Eminon. Despite having a name unfortunately close to an up-and-comer about to take the world by storm, Eminon, no name backwards, already had a small following from appearing on a short-lived reality competition show on MTV called The Cut, hosted by Lisa Left Eye Lopez. The duo consisted of a rapper and a DJ/producer, both good enough for second place on the show, forcing my favorite member of TLC to say their name a ton. They had already recorded a bunch of songs to original beats, which was more than I could claim at the time, and one surefire crowd-pleasing cover of Biz Markie's Just a Friend. In performances at our college, they changed the words of the hook to, I love USC, but I hate UCLA, I hate UCLA. I loved being on the same bill as these guys and went out of my way to become friends with the rapper, since I didn't really know anyone in the scene. He was first introduced to me as Egbert, but on stage he went by the name Allo Black. He's since gone on to become one of the more important voices in soul music, with hits like I Need a Dollar, Wake Me Up, and the TV commercial-friendly The Man, but at one time he was solely an impressive MC. Honestly, I didn't even know he could sing. I'm not sure he knew either. But his voice wasn't the only talent he was hiding. He was one of the most impressive scholars in his class. During summer break, while I was practicing complex patterns for rhyming power to drop bombs with devour your fat moms, Allo was dissecting frogs to cure cancer. That's not hyperbole. That was his actual summer internship. He also attended a class made up of students hand-selected by the university's president from the top 5%, where former U.S. presidents and Nobel Peace Prize winners dropped in for lectures. As much as I appreciated Allo's mic skills, every time we were on the same bill, I couldn't help but think we were allowing cancer to get stronger. In addition to the campus gigs, I was starting to get offers to headline venues around Los Angeles, even though I technically didn't have any original songs that Fred Durst hadn't shit on publicly. Decent meetings were taking place, and everyone ended with someone important asking when my next show was, so I knew I needed to act fast and prove I could perform. But I also knew I was missing so many elements crucial to an impressive live show. So while walking into a USC fraternity house one day, I noticed a guy moving records from his car and immediately asked if he was a DJ. When Brian Sanchez responded yes, before I could even test his skills, he immediately became DJ Sancho, the first component of my rap group. He would dig into his extensive record collection and find somewhat obscure instrumentals to play on turntables held up by cinder blocks in his room. Then I'd write rhymes to those beats and silently pass the song off as our own, weirdly similar to my days in Extra Large. I never thought I was proud of it, but the Hot Carl buzz was traveling much faster than the actual Hot Carl, so we didn't have much of a choice. Soon after meeting Sancho, at one of our first shows in downtown LA, we walked off stage and were introduced to DJ Muggs, a prolific and legendary producer best known for his work with Cypress Hill. A friend of Muggs had heard me on the radio and brought him to the show. When I asked him if he enjoyed the music, he jokingly said, "Yeah, the first time I heard it." With Sancho committed, and now that I'd finally, after numerous meetings, connected with a manager, I accepted an offer for my biggest gig yet. I would be headlining at the legendary Roxy on Sunset, a street where my mom, as a teenager, saw the Doors perform. She also made out with Jim Morrison that night and said he smelled like old tires, so the place held historical significance in many ways. It was also only a few blocks away from where I'd rapped on stage for the first time ever as an adolescent member of Extra Large, a fun fact that my mom reminded me of around 100 to 125 times in the week leading up to the show. Now, keep in mind that most promoters were contacting me through a website, hotcarl.com, that a classmate had quickly thrown together. It only displayed a logo, my name in the New York Mets font, a copyright-infringing idea that I had whipped up one night while drunk against a stark black background. Anyone could email me directly through the site, but never know what I look like, which is why many talent bookers swore I was an imposter when I showed up. One made me rap when I arrived to prove my identity, since he would have to pay me half in cash before I took the stage. So when I found out that my Roxy show had actually sold out, thanks to some radio promotion and a flyer adorned with a shirtless picture of R. Kelly announcing Hot Carl, girls 14 and under free, I made sure the club's bouncers at least saw my picture before I arrived. No matter how amateur our rehearsals felt, our naivete never derailed our plan to be professionals at the Roxy, and the same could be said about our steadfast ignorance to the cease and desist letter we got regarding that R. Kelly flyer. His lawyers didn't find the joke funny, but we were two college kids in a frat house juggling a Nubian Crackers beat and hoping people would think it was our own. What did we have to lose? No one had talked about money or an actual record deal since Mac 10, so Hot Carl still felt like role-playing at best, no matter what my ambitions were. Nice try, Pied Piper. In preparation for the Roxy show, I was forcing nighttime practice sessions with Sancho into my schedule, between studying and my social life. Most of my friends thought my burgeoning side job was cool, but still a pipe dream. They were too busy surfing, taking business classes, or chugging beer to really notice, and I weirdly appreciated that. I had started dating a younger girl named Paige, whom I'd gone to high school with and who was now attending USC to play on the school's water polo team, arguably the least hip-hop sport the college had to offer. She listened mostly to Pearl Jam, so she didn't quite share my excitement when I brought her to watch me open for Kool Moe Dee. I may have been breaking into the urban music scene, but my surroundings were like when people plan on giving leftovers to a homeless man on their drive home, but then forget the food at the restaurant. Very white. Even if it was the most Caucasian fan base in hip-hop, I knew a lot of my college friends were going to fill up the Roxy, and if I wanted Hot Carl to build on the roll call momentum, this show could be the catalyst to do that. I knew I needed something memorable to kick off the night, especially since I assumed some industry types would be attending to see if my buzz was legit. I needed something that would tell people I was more than just a contest winner. I needed something that would make them laugh. The night of the show, I sat backstage, waiting to be introduced, nervous that my first pack concert would end with the crowd chanting "fuck rap" and 50 bullies chasing me around the Roxy. Each ticket-holding member of the audience would see right through my bullshit, bum-rush Sancho for playing other people's music, and lead any interested record exec to another rapper who was actually ready for primetime. For as heralded as the show was, Sancho and I just waited alone, going through the set, making sure we knew every cue. The only time we were interrupted was when my mom walked in. "It's packed out there," she exclaimed with an excitement that usually brings along a serious jinx. "The Osborne kids are here." Frustrated, I asked my mom to stop bringing up the audience. I had also heard that members of Eminem's crew D12 would be in attendance. Any more information, and I would most likely spiral into a panic attack. Despite the overpowering fear, I knew that if we followed the plan we concocted in Sancho's little dorm room, we'd be fine. It wouldn't matter who, if anyone, was in the audience. Right then, the show's promoter walked in and gave us a 5-minute warning. Somehow, over the deafening sound of my heart pounding, I was able to tell my mom to go get changed. I was announced as the greatest roll call champion of all time, and the kid who played Rufio and Hook, to try to sustain the mystery. A lot of the crowd would be seeing me for the first time, no matter how often they'd heard my voice. Once the sound guy ended his intro by yelling, "Hot Carl," we let it sit for a few minutes, stage empty and dark, before hitting the theme from 2001, A Space Odyssey. With that, an astronaut, helmet and all, walked onto the stage holding a flag, taking each step as if in a constant fight with gravity. The flag read HK, and we dragged out the bit to overplay the drama, hoping the now cheering crowd would assume it was me in the suit. As the beat for our first song started, and the flag was finally planted in the middle of the stage, I ran out and loudly asked, "Guess who motherfucking landed?" I maneuvered from one side of the stage to the other, self-assured, influenced by every single move I'd seen during a childhood spent glued to BET. Whatever nerves I tangled with before the show disappeared as the crowd went nuts and the astronaut broke into full dance. Our suited spaceman was throwing elbows, leaning back, and doing the diddy bop. Or at least trying. The voice-trembling teenage roll caller I once was would have been impressed as I shook hands with members of the crowd from the stage and got through each verse with more and more bravado. I ditched the gimmicky button-ups and now focused on vintage rock t-shirts, designer jeans, and my Peter Sellers glasses. Everything felt much more natural. And as the first song ended, I turned around and nonchalantly thanked my mom, who then took off her astronaut helmet, bowed, and casually walked off stage. During the next 30 minutes of my set, a performance I still regard as my best, I never mentioned my mom in the spacesuit again. As hoped, I'd made the crowd laugh. To close the night, I freestyled to Lionel Richie's All Night Long, a beat Sancho manipulated long enough for me to diss members of the audience for a few minutes, much like I had battled magazine spreads in my room. Ironically, Nicole Richie was in the audience, but I didn't find that out until years later. Otherwise, she would have gotten hit with some major shrapnel too. Standing near the stage at a Hot Crawl concert was a lot like sitting front row at a Gallagher show. You were probably going to get hit with some watermelon. I focused on a few pretty girls in my eyeline and even mentioned the Osbournes in passing, mostly because I had learned how a crowd reacts to celebrity targets a few weeks earlier when I was asked to perform a song at actress Kate Towns' birthday party. When I stepped on stage to freestyle one night in some backyard for around 500 people, I was surprised to notice President George W. Bush's then 19-year-old daughter Jenna Bush in the crowd. I recognized her immediately, since it was right around the time she was cited for underage drinking and possession of a fake ID. Her face was all over the news. I did my normal freestyle routine, but waited for my last two bars to emphasize and end on a punchline directed at her. As it approached, I looked at her and said, "You could try your hardest, but you can't stop the almighty, because most rappers are fake like they were Jenna Bush's ID." I got an overpowering, "Oh," from the audience, and Jenna gave me one of those half-smile, half-what-the-fuck-just-happened faces that her father ran the country with for 8 years. Later, I would try to go up to her and say hello, but a nearby Secret Service agent halted me dead in my tracks. When I explained I was the rapper who'd mentioned her on stage, he looked at me with a disapproving smirk and said, "I know, that's why I'm stopping you." The evening I stepped off the Roxy stage, however, I knew I'd no longer be pigeonholed as a radio fluke. My mom, still in her astronaut suit, hugged me and admitted she couldn't believe where this whole thing was going. My father, who had videotaped the whole show from the audience, a job he would proudly possess for a dozen more Hot Carl shows, joined us and seemed to finally understand rap music in general, which was a step in the right direction. I wanted that high to last forever, not knowing where the next adrenaline rush would come from or if it would come at all. And that's when an excited DJ Sancho stormed in. "Holy shit, dude, a guy from Interscope Records was here. He said Jimmy Iovine wants to meet you," he revealed with a huge smile. I knew as long as I didn't have to perform for Jimmy Iovine on a street corner, I'd be all right. Chapter 7, Caliente Carlito. After the Roxy show, the industry finally started to take notice. I may not have known my intent before taking the stage that night, but I now knew what my next goal was: to sign a record deal. A few days later, I was mentioned in Hits magazine, an industry Bible at the time for A&R guys looking to sign the next big thing. I also had a meeting with Interscope founder and CEO Jimmy Iovine in the works. Although when I asked his secretary exactly when this would be scheduled, she replied cryptically, "You'll know." And I finally made that call to the firm's Jeff Quantenance to follow up on his initial interest. I had hoped to connect with him once I was more comfortable in the biz, but things were moving so quickly that I couldn't wait any longer. A meeting was set up for the following Monday. Despite my best attempts at living a double life, with these big names entering the equation and my senior year of college in full swing, I knew it was time to finally leave the Flintstones internship behind. At this point, the office had started to hear rumblings of my flourishing rap career, but I went out of my way to keep the details and my shit-centric stage name something of a mystery. As far as quitting, I didn't exactly know what to say. "I'm a rapper now," felt like an odd way to give notice to your boss, but I also wanted to be honest and not burn a bridge. I read somewhere that Plies was a nurse when his song Shoddy broke, but I've also wondered what his resignation sounded like. Given his career post-Shoddy, I hope he didn't leave on bad terms. I like to think he's back at work, changing someone's IV right now. But all my fears were unwarranted. When I let my supervisor know I was moving on, she thanked me and just hired one of the other 200 idiots anxiously waiting for an unpaid PA job in Hollywood. Possibly Plies. Another new development in my busier schedule was a weekly all-ages party in Los Angeles called, in the most endearingly dated way possible, Club Bling Bling. It was thrown by a few local teenagers from one of the most exclusive and posh private high schools in LA, and make no mistake, was just a venue for underage rich kids to get drunk, dance to 2001 hits like 112's Peaches and Cream, and hook up. 17-year-olds with last names like Katzenberg and Winkler, and young celebrities like Anna Paquin and the Olsen twins frequented the packed party, held at Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard. I was hired to host and subsequently battle 3 or 4 different amateur rappers each night. I'd come a long way from hiding my skills in a public valley high school, now battling multiple times a night for children of the uber-wealthy. It was as tiring as it sounds, especially since most of the young challengers would practice for weeks to take me out, while I had the disadvantage of meeting them only seconds before I had to annihilate them. The competition was never fierce, though, mostly due to my challenger's prepubescence, and I never had much fear of losing. It was just a paid gig to me, but it quickly became a highlight of bling bling for partygoers, right behind getting to use their older sister's ID for the first time or getting their first hand job in the parking lot. One of my more memorable lines, delivered while glancing at my watch, was, "Just give me this win, we don't have to pretend. Let's judge this shit quick as mom picks him up at 10. Most of the time I felt like Billy Madison, aggressively swatting the shots of grade schoolers, but the bloodbaths made me a shitload of new upper-class listeners, and I was fine with that. With no camera phones or YouTube at the time, these sessions live on only as myth, even if I did rack up easily 50 wins in 2 months. To be honest, though, I didn't really retain a lot of memories from these nights either. They would keep me out until about midnight, then I'd have to race back to USC, grab a few hours of sleep before morning classes, and eventually end up in a studio until late at night recording tracks for a demo to bring to meetings. It became a bit robotic, but making it a routine helped me get through it all in one piece. I didn't have much time to think about the pressure I was facing at school or the pressure I was getting to record songs as exciting as my battles. And the best news about those recording sessions, no matter how tired I ended up, was that I was finally starting to create original music I was proud of. I made a few songs with the Baker Boys, who were still somewhat involved in my project, and a few more with DJ Lethal. But it wasn't until I tapped into my non-existent Hispanic roots that I started to understand exactly what songwriting was. Talk to any avid rap historian, or even casual fan for that matter, and you'll hear that being a good battle rapper doesn't always mean you can write a hit song. Actually, history has proven the exact opposite. Battle rappers are usually awful when it comes to making radio-friendly tunes that include hooks and structured verses, and topics other than banging another rapper's mother. It's similar to how stand-up comedians aren't necessarily known for writing great movies. They're two entirely different things. Ask Chris Rock about Head of State. Proving the theory true, the first half dozen songs I made basically just bragged about how good I was at rapping, which in my defense is what 80% of all rap songs are about anyway. But to succeed in hip-hop on a mainstream level, it's about taking those raw verses and making a fully complete, catchy song with them. It's not an easy process. If it were, I probably wouldn't have written this memoir because I'd be too busy being fed grapes by Hawaiian Tropic models or whatever shit I assume Pitbull does all day. When it came down to it, being a celebrated battle rapper is actually a disadvantage, since I knew I'd have to prove my songwriting abilities if I ever wanted any of these important meetings to actually connect. So when I stumbled across a beat that sounded like a mariachi band performing at the Apollo, all created by an unknown local producer, I knew it was my chance to write a hit. We were right in the middle of what the industry was calling the Latin explosion, where Enrique Iglesias, Ricky Martin, Shakira, and Jennifer Lopez were simultaneously blowing up. Even Christina Aguilera exploited the fact that she was half Latina and won a Latin Grammy, an award show that debuted during my time recording these demo songs. In that initial Chris Schwartz meeting, somewhere between obsessing over my Missy Elliott debacle and staring at the boombox in a cold sweat, I heard him ask if I was Latin. I basically pointed at my nose and said no, and he just changed the subject. But I always wondered what would have happened if I had said yes. Would he have been excited and advised me to just mindlessly start making Latin music despite not having any evidence of my heritage? Although I never asked, I like to think that's what he was alluding to. So when I heard the beat to what would end up being a song ridiculously called Caliente Carlito, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I was going to make a Latin song. I knew little to no Spanish and figured that if groups like 98 Degrees were exploiting whatever small amount of Mexican DNA hid somewhere in their lineage, couldn't I just admit I wasn't Latin but still cash in?